So Dogen starts to tell us how 800 years ago he would sit usually on the place where we sit. We spread a thick mat on top of which we use a round cushion. The thick mat in Japanese is the zabuton, and the round cushion is the zafu. Za, zabuton, za, zafu, za, zazen. Za means sit, sitting. Either sit in the full lotus posture or sit in the half lotus posture. To sit in the full lotus posture, first put the right foot on the left thigh, right foot on the left thigh, then put the left foot on the right thigh. To sit in the half lotus posture, just press the left foot onto the right thigh. And vice versa. You don't have to do it that way round, you can swap. I don't sit in the full lotus or half lotus posture because my body won't allow me to. Well, I used to. When I started, I could sit in the half lotus posture, which would become painful after half an hour or 45 minutes. So I did that, and then I would swap every half hour, swap my leg. And then over the years, I suppose because I did it every day, I found that one day I could sit in the full lotus posture without any pain. So I did, until I had my hips replaced, and then I can't do either. Yeah. I think if Dogen were writing today, he would add something about you have to sit in a way that your body can sit comfortably. He's talking about monks in medieval Japan, where it was customary to sit probably on the floor and so on. So I always say, find a position for your legs, like Burmese style, or if you can do half lotus. If you can sit in full lotus, it's wonderful, because you feel kind of very solid, because both your knees are pressed down roughly equally, and it feels like a really strong tripod, two knees and your bum. But one of the guys I sat with for many years in Japan, Larry, he used to push his legs into full lotus, and as a result it gave him a kind of tension, so he would sit slightly curved because he was forcing his legs. And it's very important to keep the posture free, keep the back free. So it doesn't only Dogen didn't really mean only the full and half lotus. He meant in a position which will allow you to sit with your back free, I think. Sitting in seiza with both feet underneath you, which is a traditional samurai posture. Well, it's the in Japan, in medieval Japan, it was a traditional official polite posture. So if you go and see somebody important, you would sit in seiza. So you're sitting on your knees, basically. And there, tea ceremony, for example, people sit on their knees. But over a long period of time, it's quite damaging. Japanese friend of mine's mother was a tea ceremony master, and she had terrible problems when she was in her later life, because she had to sit in, you know, in seiza. And if you're doing this tea ceremony in kimono, you have to sit in seiza. She had lower back problems and knee problems and so on. So sitting in seiza, if you can't sit with your legs crossed, I don't say anything to somebody who sits in seiza, but it is a bit different. The main difference is, aside from the pressure you put on your legs, in seiza, your pelvis and your sacrum is slightly further back, which puts the centre of gravity of the line from your sacrum up through your spine to your head, push it back slightly towards the back of you. So that with the weight of your head, just causes you to sit slightly forward. So I notice that people who sit, when they sit in seiza, can't sit quite as balanced straight as somebody who sits in the traditional posture, which opens up the pelvis, rotates the sacrum forward, inboard a little bit. That rotation you can feel in your own pelvis.
When you sit on your zafu, are you sitting kind of right bang in the middle of it, or a bit further down?
Oh, I tend to sit on the front, half,
yeah,
probably.
Because what you said about your friend Larry, I think I noticed that myself today when I do full lotus. I noticed, it made me realise why my left shoulder gets so tense, because very subtly I'm kind of leaning forward a little bit.
Yes.
Whereas through what we've been doing today, I've noticed if I sit back and relax a little bit,
yeah,
everything seems to be more bearable.
Good. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
So sit more towards the kind of front half for me, Zafu.
Well, that's what I do. I tend to, because when your knees are down, and I have to have a bit more height because of my hip joints, your knees are down, you automatically rock onto the front half of your zafu. If I try to put my bum right in the middle of the zafu, the front edges of the zafu lifting my thighs up too much.
Okay.
I suppose you could try half moon cushions, and you can get all different shapes of cushions now. I think after I had my hip operations, I bought it like a half moon zafu, and it tapered off on the two sides and then came up to like a narrow zafu here, so it supports. I can't remember where I bought it, but it was very good for me after my hips were replaced, because it gave support. But as you all know, you can find the most comfortable height, position, how you do your legs. Mm-hmm. So, although Dogen only writes the two standard ways, I think if he was writing today, he would hopefully include me. Let the clothing hang loosely. Of course, clothing in those days was a black collamore, the kind of gown thing. So let it hang loosely. Place the right hand over the left foot and the left hand over the right foot. palms, right hand over the left foot, left hand on the right palm, the thumbs meet and support each other. I notice people sit with their hands in lots of different positions. Some people like to rest their hands in their lap. Some people there. My teacher always said, your thumbs should touch level with your navel. Now, he's Japanese, and the Japanese body ratio is slightly different. You tend to have a longer body and shorter legs. And so his legs were short. And so if he let his hands, shoulders relax, it would come just there. So for him, it was very natural. But if I have to bring my hands up so that my thumbs are touching level with my navel, I'm lifting more than he had to. And of course, with everybody, it's different. But I usually try not to rest my hands in my lap. And the reason for this is because if I rest my hands in my lap, I'm taking away the kind of freedom that you've got if you're not touching anything. Freedom to balance. So if you're sitting upright, left, right, and you can find the middle, that's a kind of balance point. But if I put my hands on my knees, for example, yeah, you can still find the point of balance. But if you're doing that for half an hour or an hour, you can sometimes end up putting weight through your arms. However, I think it's very subtle. If you sit with your hands in your lap. But you might notice, if your zazen is a bit hard today, that you're pushing a little bit and it gives strain on the shoulders. You can feel it, like, why don't I ring the bloody bell? And you push almost unconsciously. So I like to sit like that, rather than... just sit upright, not leaning to the left, inclining to the right, slouching forward, or arching backwards. It is vital that the ears vis-à-vis the shoulders and the nose vis-à-vis the navel are directed away from each other. This is the original... could be translated as that they're in line with each other, but actually it's difficult to know whether your nose is in line with your navel. However, you can imagine, just like they tell you in yoga positions, let them direct to what, lengthen your nose above your navel or whatever, something like that. So you kind of imagine nose and navel and let them move away from each other. Does that make any sense? And your ears and your shoulders, let them move away from each other. Direct them away from each other, which is a subtle lifting, lengthening. Let the tongue spread against the roof of the mouth. The lips and teeth come together. Eyes should be kept open. Let the breath pass imperceptibly through the nose. There was somebody who used to come to retreats and do some kind of deep breathing. It was really disturbing. and you could just hear this, and it took a while to work out who it was. So imperceptibly through the nose. So having readied the posture, make one complete exhalation. It doesn't say take a breath. It says make an exhalation. Because when you exhale, you can just allow yourself to breathe in after that. So intentionally breathe out, and then your lungs are going to fill. Sway left and right, sitting in balance in the mountain still state. In the Shobal Genzo workshop, we've just come to that phrase in the story about who was it? Master Medicine Mountain.
Yeah.
What's it? Who's Medicine Mountain?
Yakusan.
Think the concrete state of not thinking. How can the concrete state of not thinking be thought? It is different from thinking. This is the secret of sitting Zen, Zazen. So Dogen adopts Master Yakusan Nigen's phrase to describe a state which is different from thinking. So we're not thinking, we're not thinking, it's different from thinking. Can you identify some state like that? It's not a state because we're always changing.
Is it in existence?
Pardon?
Is it in existence?
Is it in existence?
Yeah, is it a existence of just being, isn't it?
I don't know. It may be. To understand the story of Master Yakusan and his phrase and Master Dogen's, you have to try and see what can he possibly mean to me in my zazen. So obviously he's talking about something which is not intellectual thinking, like when we're thinking, oh, I've got to, what's the time, I wonder, because I've got to be out of here in half an hour. In actual thinking, at the same time, we're not trying to empty our mind intentionally, which is a horrible thing. Trying to sit blankly, you know. So it's somewhere between the two. So you have to look for it and then make sense of the words, or not. So it's a description that he uses based on Master Yakusan Nigen's description. What is called sitting Zen? Sitting Zen, it means Zazen, just the way they translated it here. What is called sitting Zen is not learning Zen meditation. In Japanese, that learning Zen meditation is a word, two kanji, sanzen. Sanzen means zazen, meditation which you're doing in order to improve yourself. And so he's saying zazen is not sanzen. Many people would find the statement that I'm not doing this to improve myself quite disappointing. Well, what do I get from it then, if I'm not improving myself? And the answer comes from Kodo Sawaki: nothing. You can't get anything from zazen. Which is not quite what it sounds like, but anyway. It is just a peaceful and effortless gate to reality. Oh, yes. sometimes. It is a practice and experience which perfectly realizes the Buddha's enlightenment. To Dogen, sitting in Zazen, whoever you are, at whatever stage you are, if you sit in the posture of the Buddha, Zazen, then you are realizing the Buddha's enlightenment. So that means that we should ditch any ideas that we might have of enlightenment, of which there are many, many, and identify enlightenment, the meaning of the word, with what we're doing when we sit. Which means that enlightenment is not quite what it sounded like in the books, or what the teachers on YouTube call awakening, which sounds as if it means that you pass a point in your development after which you are somehow awake, free from all kinds of things, able to set up websites that sell books, tapes. and make a very nice income. Enlightenment, or realization, is another translation of the Japanese. It is clearly by Dogen identified as that's what the state is when we sit in Zazen, wobbling about, going in and out of changing and so on. That's what the Buddha's enlightenment was for Dogen. So not a perfect abstract state to achieve, but something we do. But it's very difficult to accept, isn't it? Could I be doing it right? Forget right, forget wrong. The universe is realized, untouched by restrictions or hindrances. Well, to me, that means that I'm in touch with everything. Sounds very spiritual, but for me, there's an experience in Zazen which is unbounded. It's not my boundaries, the boundaries of my thinking or Michael or the room, but something more subtle, which Dogen says is realizing the universe, or being one with everything, or whatever. To grasp this meaning is to be like a dragon that has found water. The dragon was a mythical, in Chinese mythology, the dragon was a mythical beast who searched for water, and when the dragon found water, he became empowered. And there's a story about the dragon looking for water somewhere in Chinese mythology, which my teacher Nishijima Roshi adopted for the title of his book, To Meet the Real Dragon. Or a tiger before a mountain stronghold. Both of these metaphors, are they metaphors? Yeah. A kind of suggesting that if you understand that Zazen is like this, then you're in touch with yourself. Mm. So you're powerful. Not power from somewhere else, just the normal power of being in touch with yourself. Remember, true reality is naturally manifesting itself before us, and gloom and distraction vanish at a stroke. At a stroke sounds a bit optimistic, but I was talking to my brother, and both he and I tend to wake up with a slightly gloomy mood. I don't know whether it's our genes or something, but we both do. And so I wake up not feeling like joyful and springing about, but slightly kind of, I suppose I better get up, you know. And then after I practice Zazen, I feel happy. So for me, I always think that means after I've done Zazen, my gloom and distractions slowly vanish. They don't vanish in a stroke for me.
A slow stroke.
Anybody else wake up gloomy?
Sometimes.
Anybody wake up joyful?
Sometimes.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it? I've got a friend, Miriam, in the Czech Republic. She wakes up joyful, like jumping about like a bloody fairy. That's so irritating. No, it's not actually, it's nice.
I'm too old to jump about in the morning.
Yeah. How about in the evenings? Do you feel the opposite in the evening?
No. Get up happy.
Really? Lovely.
There's a German word, Morgenmuffel. A Morgenmuffel is someone who wakes up in the morning gloomy.
No, it's not always gloomy. It may be if I'd had a dream, which I remember.
Don't do mornings. Yes. Mm.
Don't do mornings. That's what people say, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. So do Zazen and it'll vanish at a stroke. Maybe it is at a stroke.
Maybe that gloom is probably just you still awakening from sleep. Whatever that. I find that sometimes when I have to wake up early in the morning, maybe it's a lack of sleep or just naturally just going, oh, I have to get up. But then once I do sit Zazen like yourself, I find myself, okay, I'm ready for the day.
Okay. Yes, it puts me ready for the day.
Yeah.
And
if I do it first thing in the morning.
I pretty well always sit. And in the worst case, I'd sit for 10 minutes. But if on some occasions I don't sit, it's like I feel I haven't. Something missing.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's habit, really. What time do we finish, Tom?
Quarter past.
If we rise from sitting, we should move the body slowly. Rise with calm confidence. We should not be hurried or violent. We see in the past that those who transcended the ordinary and transcended the sacred, interesting phrase, and those who died while sitting or died while standing relied totally on this power. The calm confidence he's talking about. Many Buddhist groups in the modern world, it seems to me, believe that Buddhism is somehow sacred, and so they create a group, and inside the group we do sacred things. They may not call them sacred because it sounds a bit Christian, but inside the group we do special things to preserve the Dharma, and then outside the group we act normally, ordinary people, and sacred, so outside, inside. And there is a group of esteemed Buddhist masters in the States called the Soto Zen Association of America. And on their website it says that they are custodians of the Dharma. Custodians of the Dharma, to me, suggests that they think that they have something which is different from ordinary and therefore sacred, and that they are keeping it. And they may tell you about it if you...
If you're good.
And they certainly look like they're custodians of something. There's a photograph on the website. So to me, transcending the ordinary and transcending the sacred means cleaning your teeth is sacred, and bowing on entering the dojo is ordinary. Drinking a cup of tea is sacred, and standing up from zazen is ordinary. Moreover, changing of the moment through the action of a finger, a pole, a needle, or a wooden clapper, and exact experience of the state through the manifestation of a whisk, a fist, a staff, or a shout, can never be understood by thinking and discrimination. Well, these are all references to ancient stories. Which I can look up, but I'm not going to. Dogen says that when we act, even with a finger, acting changes the world. The moment of action, the world changes. So the moment changes. Of course it does, because moment changes to the next moment. But this experience of the world moving in action, when we act, the world moves, or we move the world, or we are moved by the world, you can't understand it by thinking about it. It's experiential. Which is why we practice. And it's the centre of martial arts too. How could they be known through mystical powers or practice and experience? He's just referring to other teachings there by people who claim to have mystical powers because they're enlightened and so on. There are some around now even. They may be dignified behaviour beyond sound and form. Dignified behaviour. So when we act fully in the moment, that is dignified behaviour. When you see an athlete performing to their full, there's dignity there. That's why we watch sport, to see dignified people, while we sit in undignified slouch on the couch.
As long as they're not doped.
As long as they're not what?
Doped.
Dope?
Doped.
Oh, doped. Yes.
Figure skating?
No, I didn't.
Poor 15-year-old Russian girl who been thoroughly trashed for having traces of forbidden substance in her blood.
Yes.
Being 15, probably didn't know anything about it. Took something given by her coach.
Did she? She
was a gold medalist and then went down to fourth in another something like that. Yeah.
So she could still perform though, couldn't she? How could they be anything other than a criterion that precedes knowing and seeing? That's quite interesting. They refers to the actions which he describes with changing the moment, the action of a finger, pole, needle, wooden clapper. They're all examples in ancient stories of action. So action is dignified beyond sound and form. How could they be anything? How can actions be other than a criterion that precedes knowing and seeing?
So unpremeditated.
Yes, nice. So it's a description, in Dogen's terms, of acting. And acting doesn't just mean doing, it means something that I can't put into words. Just do the next paragraph and then stop again. Therefore, we do not discuss intelligence as superior and stupidity as inferior. Let us not choose between clever persons and dimwits. If we make effort devotedly, that is just wholehearted pursuit of the truth. So that's very nice. As long as you're doing your best, it doesn't matter whether you are clever or stupid. Practice and experience is naturally untainted. Dogen uses the word tainted to mean when we're split between mental and physical areas, when we're not whole, we're tainted. And when we try to do something in that state, our action is tainted. So it's a word he uses to describe something that we all know about. Sometimes when we do something wholeheartedly, it just the world moves, we move forward. When we do something half-heartedly or with a lot of fear or tension, doesn't go right. We feel like we're only half doing it, and it's a horrible feeling. Practice and experience is naturally untainted. The direction of effort becomes more balanced and constant. So, stop there. We just polish off the last bit tomorrow morning. Or you can read through it now. Or do it for homework. So in his medieval way, as a man living in a temple out in the sticks, he managed to write a description of the practice that for him was the centre of his life, which I find very encouraging, because it says it's important. Sitting in Zazen is important. Look how important it is. It's salvation itself. It's the centre of... It's the best thing you can do. It's the great task. Whatever. So when I feel a bit directionless, if I read something like this, I think, oh, okay, so I'm doing something important. It doesn't matter if anybody sees it or not, or where it is, or if it's on YouTube. I'm just doing it here. And then rest of the day, I can just live. It's okay. In my little flat in the Czech Republic. So for Dogen, it's the centre of his life and centre of his teaching, and many people revere this little chapter as the most important thing he wrote. If you want the Japanese, I can send you the...
He must have written every day, don't he? To be able to produce so much.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine his, you know, how he produced all that writing. Mm-hmm. And in the Shobok Enzo, the essays or chapters, sometimes they say preached. So does that mean he wrote them down, or he just gave a lecture and somebody else wrote it down? How did they write it down? Because it was a brush, ink and a scroll. Did he speak slowly? Did he make notes? Did they make notes? I can't imagine how it all came to be written.
The other day I was doing a piece of calligraphy, and I was there like grinding the ink, you know, because for that particular piece I wanted to grind the ink, because now of course you can get the bottled, very good ink, but bottled, already diluted. But then for this particular piece, I wanted to grind them. And I was there for about an hour to grind something that would vanish like this. And I was thinking, God, how did Dogen write all that stuff 800 years ago, doing the same thing I'm doing, this little stone? You know, to, it takes so long to grind ink.
He made it part of his song, didn't it?
Probably.
Well, maybe he's... Whoever wrote it, the purpose of them writing was to record what the guy said or thought. But with you, it's more of calligraphy.
Artistic.
Artistic thing, isn't it? So it's slightly different. You can take your time.
Mm.
I don't know.
But medieval monasteries in Europe had teams of monks and had a scriptorium.
Mm.
Their job was to write things.
And did they write down, you know, as people were giving talks, or?
No, I don't think so. I think they wrote, they copied all their manuscripts.
Yes, I know they
but
copied.
It was something somebody supposedly said at some stage, so.
Definitely some of the writings, Dogen's writings, he wrote himself, because... Actually, Fukan Zazengi, there's the original, Dogen's original writing. It exists somewhere in a temple as a national treasure. But how it was all recorded day to day, I can't imagine. Because it's certain that he wrote lots of it, and then maybe talked based on what he wrote, or maybe talked and then wrote it down afterwards. But it's not clear. I've not read anything which gives a clue to how it was done.
The Romantic poets, for example, Wordsworth, in the Quantocks in the 18th century, He wrote poetry, but he didn't actually. He would smart the poetry, and his sister wrote it down for him.
Mm-hmm.
There was a general custom then that you have somebody to write it down for you.
Okay. Well, it's like, you know, somebody's recording what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Not my sister. Yeah, I don't know.